It is Monday, June 3rd, 2024, and this is Ozarks at Large. I'm Matthew Moore. Today, we spend time in Benton County discussing the damage from the May 26th tornadoes and the people offering support and relief.
You asked the question, how does it make me feel? It breaks my heart. But we've been dealt a pretty bad hand here. It's time for us now to kind of play that hand as best we can.
Everybody has come together. Everybody is doing their part in helping out. And that's what we love to see with the Red Cross. We love to see neighbors helping neighbors, and we are here to support them too, and however we can do that.
The mayor's been out here. He's going to bring the governor out. This was supposed to be one of his stops, but I guess instead she preferred to see the damage done with the businesses in Rogers instead of people's homes.
All that after the latest headlines from NPR News.
The 2024 season of Naturals Baseball continues at Arvest Ballpark in Springdale. Ticket options, a full list of promotions, and more available online at nwanaturals.com.
This is Ozarks at Large for Monday, June 3rd, 2024. I'm Matthew Moore. Thanks so much for being with us today. Ozarks at Large is a production of 91.3 KUAF, a listener-supported service of the School of Journalism and Strategic Media at the University of Arkansas. Later today, we go back in the archives for a Prior Center conversation about the documentarian Jack Hill. Randy Dixon with the David and Barbara Prior Center for Arkansas Oral and Visual History joins Ozarks at Large's Kyle Kellums to discuss Jack Hill's work and tenacity in our second half hour. First today, in the early hours of Sunday, May 26th, at least a dozen tornadoes plowed through North Arkansas, hitting parts of Benton, Carroll, Boone, Marion, and Baxter counties. Carolyn Eiler in Rogers saw substantial damage to her home. Carolyn has lived on Wood Street for 5 decades. The enormous tree that was just a sapling when she first bought the house brand new was now on top of her house.
You won't look?
Do you mind? I'll let you go first. I'll grab the door.
Oh, okay.
Thank you. Oh, wow.
Yeah, in the kitchen, you can see even worse. And if you go to the side yard, you can see the what's remaining of the garage.
Yeah. If you look right there, you can see the log.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Carolyn's niece Dawn points out that you can literally see the tree from inside the house, poking through the roof and ceiling into the living room.
Where is the bedroom, and like, where? How close were you in relation to where this hit?
Just on the other side of this refrigerator and closet. So, yeah, this is all fine. Thank the Lord.
Yeah, I mean, we're looking at like 40 feet.
Yeah.
If that.
Yeah, for sure.
Dawn and her husband Jeff live on the east coast of Florida. She says they got a text from Carolyn at 4 a.m. on Sunday.
I'm okay. House not so much. You pretty much just pick up and go. So we drove as long as we could yesterday and then made the rest of the way this morning. And my husband works for a building supply material company, so we brought tarps and trying to batten it down until an adjuster can come and then do the heavy lifting of a rebuild, or hopefully not a tear down. We'll see. We'll see.
Nearly 1,000 homes across Benton County reported home damage, according to County Emergency Management Services. Downtown Rogers was another impacted area. Governor Sarah Huckabee Sanders walked north up 4th Street with a line of officials from every level of government. She says right now it's important to see everything firsthand and assess where the greatest needs are.
Having every entity from the city, the county, the state, the federal side seen and being able to look and make those assessments at the same time, I think makes a big difference. And then we can kind of collectively work together on who will take on which piece of it.
Congressman Steve Womack was another elected official on the walking tour of damage. The group was now walking south down 3rd Street, and it became stark how some homes were severely damaged, while others barely had limbs in their yard.
This particular house has a lot to be thankful for. And I mean, the indiscriminate nature by which a tornado strikes a community has always been kind of a mystery to me as to how somebody can catch it, others don't, and what is that dividing line? How does that happen? But it's always been a kind of a source of interest on my part, because over here you see big branches down, probably not affecting that house, but these guys probably looking back saying, we dodged a huge bullet with that storm. And then you look over here, right across the street, your neighbor, and assuming they have insurance, that's a deductible and probably an amount of money for that root ball that's not going to be covered. So go figure. Heartbreaking.
Womack was the mayor of Rogers for more than a decade. He says seeing this damage with his own eyes was important.
I spent 12 years of my life leading this city, and I know a lot about it. I know a lot about the heart of the people here. It's a resilient community, but even among the most resilient, this is hard to take. You ask the question, how does it make me feel? It breaks my heart. But we've been dealt a pretty bad hand here. It's time for us now to kind of play that hand as best we can and look for the good and everything. And I think that will kind of keep our spirit.
Just like at Carolyn's house, enormous mature trees were toppled downtown. Womack says his major concern is the root balls that had been pulled out of the ground and were dangling in the air.
Hundreds and hundreds of these things that, if left to the homeowner to have to deal with, is going to result in thousands of dollars of expense that they probably do not have, and maybe insurance companies are not going to cover. So developing a strategy for how we deal with the bottom part of the tree is going to need to happen, and happen pretty quickly. So just as you can see, there's just a lot of challenges that go with it.
One more block remains on the walking tour, and Congressman Womack continues to think out loud. He wonders how much different the death toll would have been if it had happened at 1 p.m. instead of 1 a.m.
We probably, just by timing, saw thousands of people saved from some form of personal hardship, injury or death. And easily the death toll could have gone into the dozens had it struck in the middle of a business afternoon. And think of kids in school at the time, getting out about that time, if it was 12 hours sooner.
Yeah.
So I kind of benefited a little bit by it being so late at night, but never a good time.
Yeah. Do you find yourself trying to find like silver lining in moments like this?
I do. Because you have the finding of the silver lining, trying to find some means of optimism is what fuels the hope. And if you have no optimism, if you can't look for the good in bad outcomes, then you lose hope. And this city is full of hope. It's going to be fine. It's just going to take it a long time. So the ugly scars will be around for a little while. The memories will last forever. But we'll get through this. No question in my mind, Rogers, a resilient community, will get through this.
This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Daniel Carruth, and we're continuing our coverage of tornado damage across the region with more on how people are stepping up to rebuild their communities. A steady flow of cars stream into the parking lot of Rogers High School while student staff and other community members in yellow high-vis vests direct traffic and distribute supplies like water, diapers, and flashlights as people drive up.
Grandma, do we need water or no?
In the days since the tornado devastated parts of Northwest Arkansas, the school on South Dixieland Drive in Rogers has become a kind of hub for the community, offering daily meals, taking and delivering supplies, and offering shelter. Superintendent Jeff Berry says part of that was because the campus maintained power while others went without electric service for several days.
And then we had a big gym. We've got the area to do that. We also had showers that we allowed individuals to go in, use showers, you know, take bathroom, recharge their phones, do those kind of things. And then I think also we probably had access to people. And so we had, we've got 2,000 some employees, we've got 16,000 students, you know, with accompanying parents. And so I think we had the resources, I think we've got the people. And then I think most importantly, we got people with a servant heart here. We got people, this is what they were built for. They were built to serve other people. And so I think all those things came together that, like I said, 5 days ago, we didn't know we were going to be doing this, but when the call came out, this is what you get. You get people that are willing to come out and do whatever it takes to be successful.
Outside, Willie Wright sits with other RHS staff at a bench behind two fold-out tables stacked with sack lunches. The RHS wrestling coach says he couldn't imagine not helping during this crisis.
We've been volunteering the last 3 days, just kind of picking up debris and cutting trees and stuff like that, just helping the community around us. That's kind of our main goal. And
Wright says serving those impacted by the storm is important to helping the community heal from a traumatic event. And he says it's especially important for his students to be directly involved in that relief effort.
Pretty cool to see all, you know, the whole community come together. Really just, you know, help, you know, they see where work is needed and help out. I mean, we've had about 25 kids of our team show up every single day consistently from 8 to 12 and just knocking out people's yards and helping moving trees and, you know, same thing with basketball, football, and then just even people from the community coming out and donating and helping people out that need shelter and stuff like that. So I think it's really good effort. I think we're doing great here, and it's going to be a long process, but I think we're moving the right direction.
Lori Arnold Ellis is executive director for the American Red Cross of Greater Arkansas. And she says almost immediately after the storms, the best instincts of people in this region kicked in.
I do want to just say how incredible the community has been in Northwest Arkansas around this tornado. Everybody has come together. Everybody is doing their part in helping out. And that's what we love to see with the Red Cross. We love to see neighbors helping neighbors. And we are here to support them, too, and however we can do that.
The Red Cross has been working with local government, state and county emergency management, and others to ensure needs are being met throughout the communities of those affected. The group is still operating respite centers in Decatur and Yellville.
What we're finding right now is a lot of people just need something to eat. They need some cleanup supplies. We've been going around with water and snacks and different things just to kind of help people as they're cleaning up the debris from their homes. The Red Cross works with a lot of partners too, so we know that we've got partners out there who are doing chainsaw crews, and they're also helping feeding. You know, it takes a village, and we're so grateful for the Salvation Army and the Southern Baptists and all the different organizations that are out there doing all these things that people need. For our part, what we're focused on right now is those respite centers, and we are doing damage assessment. That way we can actually help people with some direct financial assistance for those whose homes have been really destroyed from this tornado.
And for many vulnerable communities, the damage is often compounded. Stephanie Takamaru is with the Arkansas Coalition of Marshallese and says at least 25 Marshallese households were destroyed by the storm, and many of them multi-generational.
Having them being displaced out of the house and trying to still continue to work and provide for the family, especially if they've been, I have seen this where multi-generational households were impacted by the tornado. Now it's just trying to balance the kids that now they're living with other family members. That's a lot of people in one household. So it's really, it does impact us because, you know, we migrated here for a better life and for a better future. And with this tornado, it's putting us on a standstill right now.
Luckily, she points out, under the latest federal agreement with the United States, Marshallese in the country will be eligible for federal assistance from the storm. But in the meantime, she says, many people are still having to rely on local aid for food assistance, housing, and other basic needs.
I'm going to say I'm really proud to see all of Northwest Arkansas community come together in oneness and in unity. I saw all these landscaping companies just donating their time to, you know, helping take, breaking down branches and cleaning up. And it's really, really, it's a really great thing to see that within a disaster, the community comes as one and try to help each other.
And while there is no shortage of places to donate or to volunteer, just search Tornado Relief Arkansas on Facebook and several community groups pop up with donation needs to cleanup opportunities. But Arnold Ellis says, before you offer to help, check that what you are offering is actually what people need.
I would definitely say that if people want to make donations of goods, they should call ahead first to find out if those are necessary. We get a lot of donations during times like this, and it's a lot for many nonprofits to handle because we aren't equipped always for a large donation of, say, winter coats when it's the middle of summer, that kind of thing.
And AJ Gary with the Arkansas Division of Emergency Management says anyone doing cleanup efforts, especially if you're using heavy equipment, should coordinate with local emergency management divisions first.
They have a better idea of which parts of the impacted area they need those resources at. I know we have groups up there that are helping to clear debris. So they need to coordinate that with their local emergency management so that we know they're there. So the local emergency management know that they're in the area and doing the volunteer work. And plus, we like to try to capture the hours that the volunteers are spending because that's all part of the disaster recovery process.
Jeff Berry with Rogers School says they have a list of needed items updated on their website and on their Facebook page every day. He also says volunteers, especially those who speak Spanish or Marshallese, are needed to help sort donations and direct people to their services.
For next week, we're still going to give out supplies. We're still going to do food. Probably going to start transitioning from distribution of things to coordination of services going into the community, helping folks clean up, helping them get back on their feet, doing some of those kind of things.
And Arnold Ellis says aid will be even more necessary in the coming weeks as the emergency cools and attention shifts away.
We are really just getting started, and we could be here for, you know, a couple of weeks, or it could be longer. We really don't know. I can tell you that we're not going anywhere right now, so everyone's planning on being here for as long as we are needed.
For Ozarks at Large, I'm Daniel Carew.
They'll get diapers, wipes, and then packing of water around the back.
Back on Wood Street in Rogers, right across from Carolyn Eiler, Douglas Alguero is busy working to make repairs to a Honda sedan. He's lived in Rogers for 18 years and has a dozen family members who live throughout town. Salguero says the home belongs to one of his siblings and saw pretty minimal damage, but his car is in bad shape.
Lo que se ve a la vista pues no necesita tanto como dice explicación, ¿verdad?
What you see in front of you, like you might guess, doesn't need an explanation.
Así que gracias por todas las personas que de buen corazón pues que se han acercado a nosotros para ofrecernos todo tipo de ayuda y con ayuda de Dios pues siempre Dios nos saca adelante. Esa es mi experiencia pues que he vivido en este acto de la naturaleza.
So thank you. Thank you to all the people that with good hearts have come and offered all kinds of help. And with the help of God, He always provides for us. That's my experience now that I've lived through this natural disaster.
Salguero says it will probably take him 3 or 4 months of saving to be able to afford to get the car fixed, seeing as his family lives mostly paycheck to paycheck.
Con poco de trabajo, pues yo pienso de que así se logra reunir algo y se puede mandar a arreglar.
With a bit of work, I think I can save enough to get the car fixed.
Lo material tiene arreglo, pues, pero lo físico no.
But I'm not complaining because the material stuff can always be replaced. Our lives can't.
Salguero says more than anything, it's been the community that has rallied around to offer immense support.
Más que todo, sí, los comunidades, más que todo, entre vecinos y vecinos, nos hemos estado ayudando a poder sacar nuestros vehículos de los escombros.
More than anything, the help has been from the community. Neighbors helping neighbors, we're helping each other remove our cars from the rubble.
Y por lo demás, sí han pasado, por ejemplo, iglesias que se han prestado para poder ofrecernos ayuda. Y más que todo la comunidad de aquí de la del estado, pues solo a limpiar las calles.
For example, local churches have come by to offer help. The state has really only helped clean the streets.
We leave the city streets of Rogers and head deep into the rural county roads of Benton County. Driving northwest on Carlton Drive, due west of Decatur, the storm damage is overwhelming. Barns that were once filled with chickens are nearly unrecognizable. Cars and mobile homes are flipped 180 degrees upside down. What was once a heavily forested stretch of road now looks like a timber yard, with enormous trees toppled and stacked on the ground. Mary Hickson lives near the end of Carlton Drive, about 20 minutes from the Oklahoma border. She and her husband Rick were in Jay, Oklahoma, when the storm hit. Their 26-year-old son Ricky was the only one in the house.
Ricky called us. He was in the closet. He called us at 1 o'clock in the morning and told us the tornado hit.
And you came back immediately?
And we came back immediately, but because, I don't know if you saw all the trees, the trees were covered. They covered the road, so we couldn't get home for about 6 hours. It was about 6:30 in the morning before we could get in.
She says once the sun came out on Monday, they saw 30 years of their stuff just sprawled everywhere in a pile of rubble and debris.
You know, every time I looked down, I'd see something that, oh, that goes in the kitchen, or, you know, all these things that were ours. And it was just hard to process all this stuff that we spent so many years was just trash.
Have you heard from, like, county officials at all? Have they come out and assessed
at
all?
We've had FEMA come out. We've had, I can't tell you. The mayor's been out here. He's going to bring the governor out. This was supposed to be one of his stops, but I guess instead she preferred to see the damage done with the businesses in Rogers instead of people's homes.
What would you want the governor to know? If you had a chance to talk to her and show you this, and show her this.
That people needed help 3-4 days ago whenever this happened. I mean, the people that, I don't know about other people, but the ones that have helped us have been family and neighbors and friends. We didn't see help from anyone, you know, any officials. They didn't send anybody out here. So thank goodness we have plenty of that. We had plenty of help, but we're still in need of help. Neighbors are still in need. You can see. we have friends that don't have insurance on their homes. And they spent a lifetime working on their home, trying to, you know, remodel and make it theirs. And now it's completely flat. So people still need help. It's frustrating because it's not quick enough. You know, I know they got to go through all that red tape, but they just need to make it a little faster.
In the meantime, Hickson and her family are living in a camper that her brother-in-law has loaned, connected to a generator, also loaned out by her brother-in-law. She says they're going through what's left of the home and taking it to storage. And she can't help but be overwhelmed as she's clearing things out.
I look at it and think, I don't know what to do next. I know I gotta get it done, but I don't know what's next, you know. It goes through my head. I know I gotta do this and this and this, and then I get out here and I'm like, can't. I can't go around and look at that stuff. So it's hard.
Is there anything I missed? Anything you want to make sure people know?
I think the biggest thing probably for most people is people need help, not, you know, it's great that we've had all the help cleaning up and the neighbors have had so much help, but funding, people need funding to help them get back on their feet. Yeah. You know, we can't live like this very long. I love camping out, but our neighbors, they don't have insurance. They are the ones that need the funding to help them get back on their feet.
More than 180 members of the Arkansas National Guard are in Benton County as of Friday, May 31st. Officials from the Guard say they were initially called for two assignments, providing potable water and assisting law enforcement. Bob Odom with the Arkansas National Guard at Camp Robinson in North Little Rock says if Benton County Services or the Arkansas Department of Emergency Management wants them to help with things like using chainsaws or any other reassignment of duties, it must be sent up the chain and approved by Guard leadership. But Odom says they plan on being there and staying there.
Know that we're there for the long haul to help out Benton County for as long as we're needed. And, if there's a need and the Arkansas National Guard can fill it and the governor approves, we're going to be there to help.
You can find a list of resources at KUAF.com/tornado relief. And if you are providing resources and would like to be added to that list, reach out to us at the email address at the top of that page. Again, that website is KUAF.com/tornado relief. This is Ozarks at Large.
I've heard him say, you know, that everything was going pretty well until Jack Hill came in and started causing all this static.
It's time to visit some Pryor Center archives. Randy Dixon's with the Pryor Center. How are you, sir?
Good, Kyle. How are you?
Good. What started us off?
Well, that was Jack Hill, a journalist, investigative reporter for KAIT in Jonesboro. It's the ABC affiliate here in Northeast Arkansas. He was born up here in Rogers.
And I always forget that he was a Northwest Arkansas kid.
Went to the University of Arkansas, graduated, then went to Mizzou for his master's degree in journalism. He worked at a few radio stations and TV stations around, but then he landed at KAIT in Jonesboro in 1975. And was an anchor and investigative reporter, was very well known up there. For about a decade, mid-70s to mid-80s, was very popular doing investigative reporting, anchoring the news. And, he did things on water quality and affordable housing and did some good investigative work. And then he started looking into political corruption in St. Francis County. And if you don't know where that is, that's Forest City, which is between Little Rock and Memphis, more in eastern Arkansas.
And last week we talked about the sheriff.
Coolidge Conley.
Yeah.
Corrupt sheriff ended up serving, he ended up dying in prison. He was sentenced to 20 years for
all sorts of things.
Yes, gambling and extortion and things like that. But it all started with Jack Hill investigating him. And he produced a 30-minute documentary which watching it, I was a little surprised that, you know, the station let him devote that kind of time to. I mean, he rips him up pretty well in this show, but this is a part of it, and it caused quite a stir.
I run this county. This is a special investigative report from Region 8 News on St. Francis County Sheriff Coolidge Conley. Here again is Public Affairs Director Jack Hill.
Conley's political success would be the envy of any politician. He's never lost. In the early 70s, Conley served on the Forest City City Council. He was elected mayor twice and has just been elected to a third term as sheriff. That looks like another 2 years in public office to go with the 12 he's already served. But there's more to the Conley record.
Yeah, I can see why it caused quite a stir. That was just a small part of the documentary.
That's right. And I mean, he looks at every little detail, which had to have driven the man nuts.
Right.
Because he had been going unchecked for years.
Undefeated.
First as mayor, yeah. Then as sheriff. The report also looked into Conley's criminal past, and it centered around illegal gambling in Hot Springs and then his move in taking it towards Forest City.
For at least the last 10 years, Conley has been shadowed by stories of his past. When he ran for mayor in 1974, he called those stories slanderous. He was referring to talk that he had led the way to bring gambling into the community. There is nothing further from the truth, was his response. When he first ran for sheriff in 1980, he claimed to be for strict law enforcement. It is a theme he has repeated in his campaigns for re-election.
It wasn't just about gambling. I mean, he got 30 minutes to examine the sheriff's record, so he also talked about his dealings.
And finances.
Yes.
Conley's business interests have increased substantially since he's been in public office. For example, records on file with the Secretary of State indicate that Conley incorporated Forest City Asphalt in 1976 while mayor and Forest City Aviation 2 years later. In 1983, he incorporated C&G car sales in Forest City. When Conley was elected, the mayor of Forest City made about $19,000 a year, and now as sheriff, he makes about $24,000. We want to interview Conley to find out how a public official on such a salary can afford getting involved in so many businesses. There are other questions stemming from our investigation we hope to ask Conley, but he's refused to be interviewed. Our offer for a response still stands.
All right, so you have this sheriff who has really done what he's wanted to do. He's run the county for some time.
Mm-hmm. And then you have this reporter
exactly.
Who is basically... I mean, it sounded to me like he's calling him out.
Yeah.
Going, we really want to talk to you.
Yeah.
Come on.
Yeah.
I mean, it was like he was baiting him. So I think you could say that Hill was a little obsessed with Conley at this point, and Conley didn't take to it too well. I mean, to the point that Hill even feared for his safety, that he was fearing some sort of retribution. And he ended up going to Tom Jarrell, who is the correspondent for ABC News 2020 with this story. And so 2020 came to Eastern Arkansas and did their own piece based on information from Jack Hill. And here is a part of that report from 2020 about a pretty frightening encounter.
Jack Hill's static was very nearly silenced forever on the night of June 9th, 1985. Hill and a cameraman were here on a public road staking out this house, known to be used as a gambling casino. Hill attempted to interview the owner of the house, Calvin Adams, a friend of Sheriff Conley's.
Can you tell me what's going on inside the house?
Yeah, we're having a birthday party.
Whose birthday?
Dalton Cummins.
Dalton Cummins.
Yeah, you want to see him?
You want to let us in there?
No.
Why don't you let us come out?
Adams whipped Hill with a microphone and then turned his rage on the cameraman.
And he turns the
television camera into a lethal weapon, and he is throwing the television camera against the news car with all the force that he has, which is a lot. And a television camera is exploding, you know. I mean, pieces are flying like shrapnel.
All right, you have seen this, right? We're just hearing it. So set
yes.
this, they're outside this house?
It's dark.
Okay.
I mean, I think you could hear the crickets.
Mm-hmm.
But this guy, they're out in front of a house, kind of out in the woods. It's outside of town, and they're camped out. And
Hill and his photographer.
Right. And this guy comes out, and we'll just have none of it. And, well, you can see this video on our website if you go to the Pryor Center website.
Yeah, we hear.
We'll have that posted.
Obviously, there was conflict, and we hear that little description from Gerald, but.
He beats him.
Oh.
With the microphone. And yeah, just swinging it by the mic cable.
So this guy.
His glasses off.
Oh, my gosh. Okay. Yeah. So you can see the video at just. Go to the Pryor Center website.
Yeah, yeah. So we go through all that, and Hill's very frustrated because, according to local authorities, the matter just ended right there.
Even though the videotape clearly shows the attack on Jack Hill was unprovoked, the local prosecutor has refused to pursue charges against Calvin Adams. A month after this beating, in August 1985, Jack Hill and Fred Odom came to 2020 with the story of Coolidge Connolly's misconduct.
That wouldn't be assault? That wouldn't be terroristic threatening?
Well, you would think, especially right. with the video evidence.
Right, right. But I guess the sheriff, Connolly, had so much power that, I mean, he's the head.
Just went away.
He's the head of law enforcement there, so his pal isn't going to be charged.
That's right, right. So now there's even more trouble. For Jack Hill, I talked to his widow, Ann, the other day, and she told me about what happened after that to Jack at the station.
By that time, the station had been sold to some people from out of state who were not as interested in investigating reporting as the previous owners had been. So basically, Jack was called in and told that he was not to make any more calls or continue his investigations into St. Francis County corruption. And Jack resigned on the spot. He said he was not going to sell his integrity.
I hear that and I think, wow. I mean, obviously you're frustrated, you're mad, you're angry. But
that takes some guts.
It does. It takes guts and it takes confidence that you can do something after that, but won't mm-hmm. have his integrity sold.
That's
just
right.
Just quit.
Yeah. So, I mean, what does he do now?
Yeah.
He's an investigative TV reporter with basically nothing to investigate, no TV station.
And this is long before cable is
reports. Yeah.
Some sort of option.
Yeah. Podcasts.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. That's
any kind of video presentation online. Right. But he ended up doing something that is rare, and it's admirable. He moved to Little Rock, and, well, Dale Carpenter.
Former professor at the University of Arkansas.
Right, just retired, has been in the business for years, and he worked with Jack Hill, and Dale will explain this idea that he came up with.
His idea was that he was going to make 30-minute documentary films, and he was going to produce them himself, write them, edit them, and he was also going to get them on commercial television. That meant he was going to buy airtime and sell commercials, because he really felt like documentaries, like he wanted to tell stories about Arkansas that he felt like maybe people didn't know about, maybe they needed to know about. And he wanted to get these things on commercial television because he felt like he would have a broader audience than if he was just on public television.
And this is where Jack Hill becomes a statewide recognizable figure.
Right. And, you know, this is no small feat.
Right.
This guy did what an entire television station does. He produced the product, so he wrote it, He was the reporter. He produced it. He edited it. But he also went out and was a salesman and sold the time. So he would go to the television station and buy 30 minutes of time that he had to turn around and recoup his money by selling his own advertising.
Wow.
And there were even times he did produce the commercials.
He was a one-man outfit.
Absolutely. And he produced a lot of material of really interesting, varied topics. I mean, they ranged from the oil industry in South Arkansas to he did several pieces on the Civil War in our state and, you know, life along the Arkansas River. A lot of interesting types of stories that Dale was talking about that he thought people would be interested in seeing. So here is a clip from one of those, and it's on the Civil Conservation Corps, or the CCC, back in the Depression.
A mountain trail in central Arkansas. Countless thousands have walked this way, only a few aware of the significance of the bridge and the rusting cable. There's a rock wall at a lake between Hot Springs and Malvern, deep in the mountains of northwest Arkansas, an overlook high above Lee Creek. Young men peer out from photographs at Crowley's Ridge State Park near Jonesboro. And there's a spillway on a dam at a state park near Morrilton.
I'm Jack Hill, and all of those things have a connection. They connect to the Civilian Conservation Corps, a government program of the 1930s in response to the Great Depression. Tens of thousands of young men were involved in Arkansas alone. There's even a statue in honor of them here at Devil's Den State Park. In fact, CCC boys, as they were called, built the foundation of the state park system.
I remember watching this very documentary with my mother, and she became incredibly interested in the CCC work in Arkansas because of Jack Hill's work.
There's a book.
Yeah. University of Arkansas Press.
Yes. Bob Cochran and Dale Carpenter wrote a book about Jack Hill, and it was called Reporting for Arkansas.
Yeah.
And it's a great book. It's just come out, and there is also a link that you can get on our front page on our website at the Pryor Center that will take you to a large sample of his documentaries, and you can view them.
Cool.
So I also asked Dale what it was like working with Jack.
He was a journalist above all things. In other words, he felt like that was his mission, to report truth and report accurately. And he wanted to tell the story about things in Arkansas that needed to be told. And so to work with Jack was kind of like going on a mission.
Finally, I asked his widow, Ann Hill, to sort of sum Jack Hill up.
He was one that never gave up. He believed in always giving your best. He was tireless in those things he believed in. He was stubborn. He held fast to doing what he thought was right and would not back off.
I'm excited that we can watch his documentaries, because they were something else at a time when you didn't really see a lot of that in Arkansas. I mean, 30-minute full-length documentaries.
Oh, that was very unusual.
Yeah.
And they would usually, you know, like I said, air after a newscast.
Right, 6:30.
Right.
What's called prime access in television lingo.
Very good. Yeah, All right. Yeah, so let's just hear how he would close out his reports, because there's a reason the book is called Reporting for Arkansas. But here's the closeout of the CCC story.
There have been a lot of sunsets since the CCC boys were at Mount Nebo and those other state parks. But we will continue to benefit because of what they left here. This is Jack Hill reporting for Arkansas.
All right, and you think about it, we got to Jack Hill through Coolidge Conley.
Through
Wayne Dumont.
That's right.
It's kind of a
Hey, it got us through a month, didn't it?
It did. History has a through line. All right, we're going
to. It's a small state, isn't it?
It is a very small state, as we find out. Thank you, Randy.
Tomorrow on Ozarks at Large, Baptist Health in Fort Smith is exploring innovative ways to combat food insecurity, such as utilizing the hospital's roof as a growing space.
And that's where the garden comes in, too, is we can now supply them as well with fresh fruits and vegetables that they can keep. So we're trying to make sure that we can hit all those points within our community.
Ozarks at Large's Jack Travis takes us to the top of the hospital tomorrow at noon and 7 p.m. on 91.3 KUAF. At 7 p.m., on Little Rock Public Radio, and on the Ozarks at Large podcast. The University of Arkansas provost has announced he will be resigning. Terry Martin announced in a press release on Friday that he would be stepping down on June 30th, 2025. His time at the University of Arkansas spans 40 years, beginning as a graduate research assistant in the College of Engineering in the 1980s. The search for a replacement will begin in full this fall, with more details coming over the summer. And the 2024 Arkansas Razorbacks baseball season has come to an end. The fifth-ranked team lost on Saturday night to Kansas State 7-6, moving them to the elimination round. The Hogs came up short Sunday afternoon, losing to Southeast Missouri State 6-3. They end the season with a record of 44-16.
From Little Rock, I'm Stephen Cook with Arkansongs.
Well, I got an earworm on and piped up a hogging dove. She was the sweetest little woman that your men most ever saw.
Beyond Arkansas's disproportionate number of musicians relative to its population, there are also plenty of songs mentioning the natural state, its people, and cities. Heard here is Booker White with Pine Bluff, Arkansas, recorded in 1937. During this period, White often recorded with Walnut Ridge native Washboard Sam, and White had developed his near-drone style of blues heard on classics like Parchment Farm. Unfortunately, neither are evident here, but Pine Bluff, Arkansas is still a great blues man's homage to an important Delta town.
My baby, she called me. She called me a bony bone. Well, she called me. She called me a bony bone. She said, "Daddy, daddy, I don't come no hurry up."
If in Jefferson County paying musical tribute to county seat Pine Bluff, you'd be remiss not to mention Cedell Davis. The longtime Pine Bluff resident was born in Phillips County. Davis's observations about his adopted hometown gave him his most notable song, If You Like Fat Women. The song was originally recorded by Little Rock native Robert Palmer for Davis's 1993 release, Feel Like Doing Something Wrong. This version is from 1998's album, The Horror of It All.
I had out of her help. She fell across me. She like a match me to death now. If you like flat women, come on down to Pine Bluff, Arkansas. You know, old flat women been down there in any place I ever saw.
Nods to Pine Bluff, Arkansas, and blues songs make sense. More enigmatic is Tony Joe White's 1971 song concerning what sounds like a supernatural event further south in Chico County. They caught the devil and put him in jail in Eudora, Arkansas. The long-titled song seems to tell the literal story of its name. They caught the devil and put him in jail in Eudora, Arkansas has at least a couple of other Arkansas connections. West Memphis native Wayne Jackson plays trumpet, and Blytheville native Mike Utley plays organ and piano. White has other songs mentioning Arkansas, including Backwoods Preacher. Very nearly an Arkansas native himself, revered songwriter Tony Joe White was born in Oak Grove, Louisiana. Actually, very close to Eudora, Arkansas.
Now the jailer had been a poor man, but now his pockets were stuffed with money. And he was sitting outside in a brand new Continental Lincoln. With fender skirts on it. Could not say where he got the money. Was he a part of the devil's bargain? And did he set him free that night in Eudora, Arkansas? Now who's to say?
Back to Little Rock, rock me. Take me back to Little Rock and hock me.
Speaking of revered songwriters, they don't come much more lauded than Johnny Mercer. He's the lyricist behind such songs as Hooray for Hollywood, Moon River, and Blues in the Night, among many others. You wouldn't think Mercer would bother recording other songs, but heard here is his version of Lucky Millinder's Take Me Back to Little Rock, Arkansas. Like Mercer, Millinder was a performer as well. In fact, Millinder recorded with Woodruff County native Rosetta Tharp, and Millinder's band once featured Hot Springs native Henry Glover. No word on why Mercer was moved to record it, but Take Me Back to Little Rock does rhyme, something like a Johnny Mercer song would.
All the gals are sweet and sunny, 'cause they're raised on milk and honey. So rock me in Little Rock, Arkansas.
From Little Rock, I'm Stephen Cook with Arkansongs.
Arkansongs is a production of Experiment Station Studios. Executive producer is Keith Merks. Arkansongs, since 1998.
Arkansas Arts Council, bringing Arkansas performers and audiences together through its Arts on Tour grant. Learn more at arkansasarts.org.
Ozarks at Large is a production of 91.3 KUAF Fayetteville. Contributors to today's show included Daniel Carruth, Kyle Kellums, Randy Dixon, and Stephen Cook. Rachel Sanchez-Smith translated conversations for our show today, and Jack Travis provided photos and website support. You can find some of those images at our website, ozarksatlarge.com. You can also find storm relief resources at the top bar of our website, kuaf.com. Today's show was produced in the Bruce and Ann Applegate News Studio 2. I'll be back with you tomorrow for a brand new edition of Ozarks at Large. Kyle Kellums will be joining me back from vacation on Wednesday's edition of Ozarks at Large. From the Carver Center for Public Radio, I'm Matthew Moore. Thanks so much for being with us today. Be well.
Theater Squared presents the world premiere of Responders, June 5th to June 30th. In this dark comedy about trying to do the right thing, two paramedics navigate a deadly scene that every school bus in the county is about to drive by. When the local star reporter arrives, things go from bad to ridiculous. Tickets and more information at 777-7477 or theater2.org. And Music Moves presents the 2024 Freedom Festival, celebrating Juneteenth, Saturday, June 15th on the Shiloh Square in downtown Springdale. This community event features live music from Cameo, Twista, and Donnell Jones, with food trucks, giveaways, a kids zone, and more. Information at freedomfestivalar.com.